everybody on a team should be a leader, but only one unlucky bastard is the manager.
Hey, folks. Welcome back to Executive Runtime. I'm your host, Johnny Austin. Our guest today is Catherine Kohler, Director of Productivity Engineering at Netflix, where she leads teams enabling developers to build better software. Previously head of engineering at the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, she's a respected technology leader and mentor, passionate about creating environments where everyone can excel. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Johnny, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I saw a recent, well, I don't know how recent it was, but I saw a previous talk where you said you wanted to design race cars for a living. That sounds pretty badass and exciting. So what happened there?
Yes. I was fortunate / unfortunate enough to grow up in the beautiful state of Florida. And one of our pastimes down there, with the support of my family, was racing cars. And so I was a big gearhead from the moment I stepped behind the wheel. At the ripe old age of 14, I actually learned how to drive on my grandfather's Jeep Jimmy from the 1950s. So my dad and my uncle were very much into racing. And as soon as I got my official license at 16, I started racing too. And I was just so fascinated by how everything pulled together. I've been a big STEM nerd my whole life, that I married my hobby with my desires to pursue race car design professionally. So, you know, majored in mechanical engineering as an undergrad and kind of went from there, but then quickly got diverted after I graduated into more of a software field because I wanted to stay in the Bay Area.
Yeah. Yeah. Was that the sole reason? Or, I mean, was there anything about software that you kind of fell in love with? I'm just curious. I mean, to me, these are just completely different worlds in my mind. So it's just, it's fascinating.
Well, I took an intro to CS class as an undergrad, and I actually didn't like it all that much. I did a pretty terrible job of designing tic-tac-toe in C. I thought it was interesting, but I wasn't great at it. And then when I graduated, I started working at an engineering automotive tooling company called Snap-on Tools, writing engine diagnostics. And they needed somebody who had some experience with software development. And I was a kid who had a ton of confidence and hubris, which was not matched by capability coming out of school. And I volunteered and actually ended up really enjoying the work. And it scratched the same itch that I had for engineering and problem solving and creativity. But one advantage that software development has over mechanical engineering is the development lifecycle is so much shorter. Right? You can sort of get things up and running pretty quickly. And I was like, wait a second, this is kind of cool. And I have no desire to move out of the Bay Area. And also, it was a kind of a different time back in the day where it was a very male-dominated field, mechanical engineering in the automotive space. And so I kind of took all of these opportunities and a signal that the stars were aligning around potentially a different career, which was just as technical, just as interesting, just as creative, but a little bit cleaner and faster. And so that's where I started exploring opportunities in software and ended up leaving Snap-on and taking a position at a company that would hire me with very, very limited experience in development.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I guess to be fair, building a tic-tac-toe game while having to manage your own memory would suck the joy out of it no matter what.
Hey, you may be a C hater, but C is the foremother of C++, which is one of the best languages ever. It's sort of like learning Latin, right? You have to suffer, but once you know it, damn, you're going to be good at all the other languages.
Yeah. I can agree to that. Cool. So something I see leaders sometimes struggle with is the sort of the balance between technical knowledge versus leadership, especially as teams expand. And have you found that balance to be hard to strike? And if so, how have you found it? And what's the right amount of technical leadership versus people leadership, particularly in an organization like Netflix, where the bar for talent is so high and the product is highly technical?
Yeah, well, we have this concept at Netflix, which I really like. It's called informed leader, which means you're not just somebody walking around with a mug, pointing out, hey, you missed a semicolon here, or, sort of that level of involvement. Like, you have to know basically what's going on the team from a technical strategy perspective, from a technical health perspective, from a product perspective, from a team health perspective. Who are your partners? Who are your customers? How do we help connect the dots? Because we're a very high context, not control type culture. And in order to provide the necessary context that your teams need to be successful, you have to be able to grok technically what's going on, not to the degree that our individual contributors do, of course, because they are hired to be those experts and hands on keyboard, but to a degree where you can help move the furniture out of the way, right? Unblock people in their progress, look around corners, connect dots, help teams operate in a way that is more productive and effective. So that level of informed leadership is critical for the types of roles that we do. I'm a couple levels removed from individual contributors in some cases. I can't have ground floor knowledge. I hire excellent engineering managers who are experts in their domain, right? So when we're looking for talent at the leadership level, at that first line of management level, we make sure that folks are really deeply, deeply expert in those domains so that I can then have kind of another hop, right, in terms of what I'm looking at and how involved I am with those teams, technically speaking. So the areas, as I've continued to move throughout my leadership career, the areas that I focus on is how the sausage is made, right? And that's from a people perspective and from a process perspective, little p process perspective, how things fit together. And so I can nudge and give feedback and provide support and guidance and recommendations and coaching and mentoring for the next line of managers that report up through me. So you can't stay as informed as on the ground floor. And I would say that's not the goal because then you become a blocker, right? If you're critical path on anything because, oh, wait, we need to get sign off on architectural designs from our manager or our manager is hands on keyboard. And they're contributing a large, piece of the pie. That's great, but is that really the best way that you can help your team? So, short story long, surround myself with people who are experts in the areas where they need to be expert, and I'm the person that's helping pull it all together, and provide cohesion and context and sort of experience in the areas of like, this is how we make good software. This is how we build really good teams.
I like the way you phrase that, high context, not control. It reminds me of Netflix's reputation, with the famous, or some would say infamous, culture slide. And it talks about building accountability in an environment with quote unquote minimal rules. I don't know if that's a direct quote necessarily, but that's like the take online. So I'm curious on your approach in that type of culture, something that values freedom and responsibility. How do you approach that, when you're hiring talent, growing talent, and thinking about how people should be operating on a day-to-day basis, particularly for teams that are, hybrid or remote?
Oh yeah, that's a really meaty question. We are famous and infamous, like you said, for this culture memo. And one of the things that really attracted me to Netflix was the culture and how it was described, and the fact that we actually live that culture day to day. It is a really pleasant surprise because oftentimes companies can lay out, this is our culture, and it's largely aspirational, right? So we really do mean context not control. We really do mean we as leaders and across the organization empower team members to make the best decision at the level that they are within the org. And what I spoke to earlier about having our individual contributors and others who are experts in their area, they are, in a lot of cases, our decision makers. So we push our decisions down to the spots where folks are most informed and then help to make sure that they are informed. There is a book that Reed pulled together in collaboration with another author called No Rules Rules. We don't have a lot of policies, if any. We don't have a lot of rules, but how we make that work, because it's not the Wild West free-for-all, is we hire unusually responsible people, people who demonstrate excellent judgment, even when nobody's looking. So folks that are, take their jobs very seriously. Not that, folks elsewhere don't take their jobs seriously, but we're looking for that judgment where you don't need as much rigor and structure and established rules to get your job done, because we're counting on folks to come in, who have a lot of experience or a reasonably good judgment to make the right call. So freedom and responsibility has actually evolved a bit, which is like freedom and ownership through responsibility. When we originally had freedom and responsibility, some folks would be like, hey, it's my choice. I get to decide. And that kind of overweighted freedom over responsibility. But what does it mean to really make a responsible decision? That means doing your due diligence, farming for dissent, ensuring you have as much data as you can without reaching diminished returns to make a good decision, including others in that decision making. It's not YOLO. We generate an environment with high trust, predicated on excellent judgment. People make mistakes, of course, right? And we learn from those mistakes. We also have a very strong culture of feedback, right? So people who are there to help and support you along the way. It's a tricky thing to navigate, but when it works well, it works really well. And I've never worked at a place before where I've been treated more like an adult who's sort of in charge of all of my own things.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you build in the accountability frameworks for an environment like that, particularly as a leader for your particular team? What are the things that you look out for, the things that you feel are good leading indicators for being successful in that type of environment?
Yeah, I simplify it down to do what you say and say what you do, and provide some mechanisms for your teams to keep people apprised. So, hey, we have set this goal. This is how we measure success around that goal. We're going to meet regularly to discuss how we're doing against those goals. We're going to operate with a really nice first team mindset where you could have your PM, TPM, engineering manager, designer in one group sort of talking about what does success look like and providing healthy tension on their particular areas of expertise. And we have every 3 weeks a status update, which is more of a risks and blockers and challenges and how can we help than a check the box. This is, we did this. A lot of questions that'll come up during those conversations are, well, how is this really impacting the customer as opposed to did you ship the thing, which is really important. And so with that level of visibility also brings accountability, right? Your team signed up to do this work. Are they achieving the goals? And if not, how are we adjusting either the goals, the scope, the timing? Maybe we're looking at the wrong thing and it's not having the intended consequence that we were hoping for. So that's how we sort of create this culture of accountability within my organization. I also really, at my level, just look at the team as an atomic unit and rely on the engineering manager to be more focused on individual accountability.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Switching gears a little bit, you've been pretty open about your journey to building your communication skills. Can you talk a little bit about that journey? What's that been like for you? What type of challenges did you have to overcome? And how has improvement to those skills helped you in your career?
Yeah, you never grow more than when you royally screw up at something, right? And take a beat and go, oh man, that I am just not nailing it here. So I have always been a very direct person. And that is awesome in certain contexts, but also not awesome when you hurt people's feelings. And I early career as a leader made someone cry on their birthday. I gave them some pretty truthful, factual feedback in the moment and really upset them. And then learned later that it was in fact their birthday. I felt terrible to begin with, but I felt doubly terrible that that was that individual's experience because of me, right? And I quickly learned that it's not you catch more flies with honey, but you can still be very authentic in the things that you want to say, but say them in a way that'll actually land and be received well by the other person. And I've gone through a lot of iterations on this. I've given a talk, my own communication journey, and the most impactful book that I have ever read to improve communication and just how you show up with people. That being the How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and How to Listen So Kids Will Talk, which is a book from the 1970s. I'm going to get hand wavy when I'm equating my team members with toddlers, but we're all kind of toddlers on the inside. And it really transformed the way that I think about how I show up, how I actively listen, how I engage with people, how I make space rather than taking space, when it's a good time to just shut up and be there for someone, be explicit about the things that I'm trying to do, like, hey, do you want me to problem solve with you? Do you want me to just be a sympathetic ear? What are you looking for right now? Because as engineers, all we want to do is solve problems. And when someone comes to you and they're in pain, they're frustrated, they're angry, sometimes they don't want you to solve their problem for them. They just want you to hear them and acknowledge and validate, right? So a lot of my journey has been modifying my behavior because I've literally walked into a buzzsaw by saying the wrong thing. And so I have been able to sort of, I'm kind of like a bonsai, right? Like just a little nip here and a little bit here. And then over time, I'm sort of developing my own communication strategy where I won't compromise on my authenticity. Mm-hmm. But I can compromise and meet the other person where they are and how I deliver and how I receive, right? And it's just to become a much more accessible, earnest, and empathetic individual rather than someone who's trying to shortcut communication and thinking that that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I have this image of you now. Before you go into one-on-ones to deliver feedback, you're just checking the HR system to see if it's this person's birthday or not, just to make sure.
You're not wrong. Oh my gosh. I know. I never want to be the reason for someone having a terrible day, right? Yeah. Then I have failed at my job.
Yeah.
So.
Cool. I'm curious, just stepping back a little bit on sort of your path from an individual contributor to leadership. What did that journey look like? And you know, how did you make the decision to go into leadership? And, you know, how do you feel about it looking back? Would you do it again if you could do it all over again? What type of challenges you faced?
Yeah, I would say I was a begrudging leader. I had moved on from that job at Snap-on Tools into a full-fledged software financial company. And I was really learning how to be a software engineer. And when I was tapped on the shoulder to move into more of a leadership position, the people above me saw that I was a communicator. I liked to talk. I liked to mediate. I worried about relationships, despite the warts on some of my communication skills. And I was working in a satellite office and they needed someone who could bridge the gap between satellite and mothership. Yeah. And I was tapped on the shoulder to take on a couple of folks, one of whom was suffering from performance issues. And I didn't want to do it because I still felt like I had so much to learn on the technical side that I would be shortcutting my career. And also, you know, when you're an individual contributor, you kind of thumb your nose at leadership and management.
Yeah.
Or like, what do they do? Really, what do they do? Right. So I took a step back and I thought about it. And I talked with my boss at the time and said, look, I really want to be a player coach. I still have so much to learn. I will take on a couple of people, but we're going to keep it small until I give you the signal that I feel comfortable moving on, if I'm lucky to do so. And I actually had a really transformational moment. One of the people that I inherited, they were struggling. And I sat down with them and said, look, you're on the ropes here. People are not seeing what they need to see out of you. You're not giving updates. You're incommunicado. You bury your head. You work on things. And the perception is that you're not performing. And that was the first time anybody had actually talked with this individual about performance and what does good look like. And they turned it around immediately. And it was a light bulb moment for me that I can have a really big impact as a people leader. I don't want to lose the technical side because then I won't be respected as a people leader. I'll be a mug toter, pointy-haired boss kind of thing. But that for me was like, you know what? I can do this. And I was probably like B plus, A minus developer, if I'm honest with myself, but a much better leader, and I could have an impact that way. So I stayed player coach for many years. I even went back to being an individual contributor at a couple points in time in my career, just based on opportunity and based on, having kids and coming back from having kids and not wanting to manage even more stuff out of the house when I'm already managing enough stuff at home.
Yeah.
And trying to continue to build out a more technical, base for myself, because it was a very narrow lane given my education. But on the people side, that's where I apparently do well. So
yeah.
I gave into it at some point in time and just like, all right, I'm on the manager track now.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a fellow begrudging manager export from the engineering world. I was a hard no when I was first approached about the job. So they had to come at me a couple of different times. So I eventually gave in. So
yeah.
I definitely understand where you're coming from.
Yeah. I have this saying that I use a lot and my team would roll their eyes, but everybody on a team should be a leader, but only one unlucky bastard is the manager. I love my job. I love my role in leadership. I love the impact that I can have and the relationships and the opportunity to grow teams and see people thrive and do their best work. But it is a hard job. It is a hard job. And, there's a lot of anxiety and am I doing this right? Am I messing with somebody's life right now? I'm making a decision today that could really blow up down the road. Just quantifying success is so much harder.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I don't think many people who have never managed kind of realize the burden that comes with the role, particularly for folks in large organizations, and particularly because of the decisions that you have to make, right? It's one thing to have decision-making autonomy sort of like at the code level or at the IC level, but when you're making decisions about big groups of people and people's careers are on the line and business results are kind of up in the air, and it comes down to you. You just kind of have to make a decision, and much of the time there is no good answer. You just need an answer.
Yeah.
And that can be pretty daunting.
It's the decision and then the follow-up to that decision in terms of how do you land the plan? How do you continue to support that decision? How are you setting up people for success?
Yeah.
And then having the humility to look back and say, did I make the right call? What could have gone differently? What could have gone better?
Yeah.
So trying to lead an examined life, but not so examined that leads to distraction and inaction. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm curious, when you're kind of facing these types of decisions, what processes do you follow? Do you have any decision-making frameworks, or you just kind of, put your thumb in the air, kind of see where the wind is going, a little bit of both? How does that look?
Yeah, I like to trust inputs from brilliant people that I have surrounded myself with. I don't want to go very broad with a decision because that can cause a lot of swirl and distraction. So I'll try to think through who can help inform me, who can give me a good gut check, who's not afraid to say, it's a really bad call and here's why. We're a very transparent company and we write a lot of memos. So oftentimes, if there's a controversial decision that you have to make that can be shared outside of your own brain, then you put it down on paper and you farm for dissent. And it's very unemotional. And you get as much feedback as you can, again, without distraction, and realize you can't satisfy everybody. And then you make the call. So you get some data. If there's a POC, do a POC. You can trial balloon things with people. You can say, all right, now argue me out of it, kind of thing. But sometimes they're very sensitive decisions that you have to just keep inside your own head or share with a very limited group of people, in which case I would say it's part intellectual and part gut, and hopefully not one taking over on the other. I've been in this industry for 30 years. I've seen a lot of stuff. Hopefully I've been able to file a lot of it away. So at this point, I feel like I can triangulate relatively accurately about this is a decision that matters. This is one that doesn't really matter. It's a two-way door. We can unwind it. Yeah. And this is how to land that plan if we do go more of the controversial or spicy route.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. What would you say is probably your biggest career setback? I mean, something that you really tripped over and fell in it and kind of learned from.
I'm a very binary thinker. Like there's right and there's wrong. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I would not accept nuance. And for me, that would frustrate me. And I would leave roles because of it. Yeah. I call it dying on the hill of self-righteousness. And so early career and even mid-career, I would get frustrated by, a dynamic, a situation, politics, other things, and just say, this is right or this is wrong, without taking a moment to understand how much agency I have in those spaces. And I know I'm speaking in like lofty terms here, which, platitude. And then I would pick, so I would die on the hill of self-righteousness and I would have like 30 hills that I had identified. Yeah. Right. And I, if you look at my LinkedIn, 4 months, 9 months, 2 years, 2.5 years. I think for my own career, if I had stayed through some of that and focused on not all of the things, but really picked the hills and waited for the right opportunity, political capital, political will, approach it differently. Some of those situations, I think I would have stuck around longer and my career probably would have progressed further. I have no regrets though. I have no regrets. I've learned so much from all of my previous roles and I'm really appreciative of the role that I have now and what led me here, even though at times it has been painful.
Yeah.
But I would say I got to pick my battles and I'm not right all the time. Even when I'm like, oh, this is so clear, like, why can't everybody see it? There's something I'm missing, right? Yeah. And it's my job to figure out, what am I missing? How are people seeing this? How are people coming at it? Assuming good intent and going from there.
Yeah, yeah. So you mentioned the, 9 months here, 11 months there. Some folks would, identify that as quote unquote job hopping, and they would say that it hurts you long term. I'm curious, when you're evaluating talent, is this something that you look out for? Is this a red flag, yellow flag, given your experience? I'm curious how you view that.
Yeah, for me, so the 4 month thing, I just picked the wrong job. I came back after parental leave and I'm like, oh, this is no good. This is, I really did not. I took what I could get and I was there and I'm like, this is not for me. And I can easily explain that in an interview. And I think hopefully people are empathetic to that. The second one, the 9-month one, that was my program getting canceled. And, you know, our whole team was moved on to something else. But we didn't like the thing that we were moved on. So everybody left. Yeah. And knowing that I have my own stories about why each one of these things happened in rationale, I know that other people have stories too. So a flag would be 4 months, 6 months, 6 months, you know, and you're not a contractor, right? Yeah. That would be like, well, something, you know, at some point in time, when is it that the person is not a great evaluator of of role fit, or there's something else going on? So there is a little bit of a threshold that I will hit when I'm looking at a resume. But in this industry, 2 years in a role is pretty good, right? That would not, you know, cause me to say, what's going on here? Now, if I hire somebody, my investment would be hopefully they will stay longer than 2 years. So that then becomes a conversation during the interview, right? Yeah. Let's talk about extenuating circumstances. Let's talk about, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And some people will say, it was totally the company, blah, 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 blah. And other people will say, like, you know what? I did a lot of growing during that time frame, or, you know, the finances were great. And you can understand, like, hey, this is somebody that I can invest in. So there's kind of a tipping point for me when looking at a resume. But I want to give people the benefit of the doubt if they're a little bit on the bubble to explain what happened.
Yeah. Cool. So talking a little bit about organizational change, I believe you were at Netflix through COVID, right?
Yeah. I started September 2020, like in the thick of it. Yeah.
Got it. So I imagine, you know, and this is not a Netflix thing, but just kind of where that company is in terms of its business and, you know, the quote unquote streaming wars. And there was a lot happening, a lot of competition coming to market. And I'm curious on what was that like internally? And then, you know, how did your team respond to that? And how did you respond? And was that a difficult time to lead? Or I'm just curious on like what that dynamic was like.
Well, coming in during the pandemic was really challenging. I didn't have an opportunity to meet people on the team, and coming in at the director level, people are already going to be skeptical of you, right? It's so one of my hopeful superpowers is in person, face to face conversations, relationship building, and having that be entirely remote means it has to be scripted and scheduled, which is not awesome. And Netflix was very new to working in a hybrid way as well. Fortunately, we're a memo-based culture, so we had a lot of that async collaboration down, but not to the degree that it would be necessary. Netflix has done a really great job of evolving to meet the challenges of hybrid collaboration now. And, you know, great meeting hygiene, ensuring that people are included in conversations, async, sync. Otherwise, we are one of the very few companies that has not had a return to office mandate. And we've been able to leverage that by hiring exceptional talent, wherever that talent may be, right? Which opens up an entire opportunity around diversifying our workforce as well, right? Which has been really, really awesome. I did struggle early on. I mean, everybody was struggling in terms of this existential threat of a pandemic, you know, collaboration, different ways of working, working from pajamas, working from bedroom, not being able to turn it on and off. It's like you're home, right? And people are getting better about that now and having a separation. There were also some folks that were going through a lot a lot more because they had been directly impacted by COVID and weren't dealing well, right? And so there was a natural drift in productivity from some individuals that maybe they could or couldn't recover from. And so how do you think about that from a performance perspective? How much grace are you giving people? And you know, were they a great performer before and now they're dipping and then, you know, they just can't get back? Like, how do we think about that? Because at the end of the day, it is a business, right? But you want to be human and respectful. Netflix, I would say, you know, we have a lot of competitors. The streaming wars, I can't say, are they over? Are they not over? Because, you know, headlines are very binary and shock jockey. Like the streaming wars are, you know, Netflix is won, Netflix is lost, Netflix is won. It depends on the day.
Yeah.
I think that we, you know, we have a lot of competitors for short form, for long form. We're competing with studios that have been in business for over 100 years. We've got a lot of things to think about, but we've managed to be very successful because we offer one thing, exceptional content. And we had to, you know, sort of, we had a big surge in how many people were watching Netflix during the pandemic. You know, we saved family time and relationships and had a big role to play in escapism for folks. But once we started to emerge from the pandemic, could we sustain that type of growth? No, we have to be very thoughtful about how we retooled internally to be even more productive, which is great for a productivity organization, and how to be even more efficient, right? And so how do we, you know, how do companies that are kind of big and doing good things in their space, they improve on operational efficiency, they try to create more, you know, compelling content, et cetera. All of these things are big challenges that Netflix is definitely tackling head on.
Yeah, yeah. The famous Netflix, Are You Still There feature, is that a cost-cutting feature or is that for the user?
Oh, you have to tell me about this one. Maybe I'm not as up on my product stuff. Are you getting pinged to make sure you're still alive?
I mean, not me so much because I can't sit still for anything, but, you know, I guess this is still a thing that happens.
Oh, yeah. Is this while you're watching it or is it
I guess if you just don't touch the TV in a while, like you don't do anything,
I guess
because you're binging and then after a certain while, because you all also flip to the next episode. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Oh, my gosh. Maybe I'm so old that I can only binge two things at a time now and then I have to go to bed. Yeah, I can imagine that is more of a probably two things. If I can armchair product manage that one, streaming is resource intensive. So why keep streaming to an empty room, so to speak? And then the other one is like you're going to have to claw back and figure out what were you watching? I fall asleep to true crime podcasts. And I at least, which is, you could debate whether or not that's good for your mental health or not. But I set a timer and, you know, I very frequently fall asleep after about 2 minutes and then I got to claw my way back to where I was before. And that's not a great process, right? So, so why not? You don't want to keep just,
just
set that plane to autopilot. So both from a cost savings perspective and from a let's be nice to our customer perspective.
Yeah.
So that's a win-win.
Yeah. Excellent.
Oh my gosh. I know. We try to do what's best for our customer. We try to make it easy to cancel. We try to make it easy to rejoin. We don't lock you in.
Yeah. Cool. How do you create environments where your people can thrive?
Oh gosh. So first of all, hire great people, keep talent density high. That's through coaching, mentoring, feedback, and performance management, which is the sort of darker side of keeping talent density high, but absolutely necessary. I try to create a fun environment. You know, we are so privileged to work on the things that we work on. it is not heart attack serious. So let's keep it enjoyable. It doesn't mean that people don't work really hard and put in the time. But I also try to maintain people's balance, right? No good work happens after about 45 hours. I'm a big believer in that. And, you know, being able to tell a good narrative about the work that people do and how it impacts our customers. Folks within productivity engineering just want to make people more productive.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, and when people are more productive, they get more done and they're more satisfied with the job they're doing. They're not fighting tools. They're not fighting, you know, infrastructure. So it's pretty easy for us because our customers are literally in the building, and figuratively in the building, to get a really nice feedback loop about the impact that we're having and the success that we're having. Mm-hmm. So, you know, keep it light, keep it fun, keep people focused. That bottom-up decision-making is also one that attracts top talent and keeps talent happy. So mostly our jobs are fostering a great environment and getting out of the way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. How do you think about career risks, and what are the risks that you've taken in your career that you feel really paid off in the long term?
Yeah. One of the ironies about working in a place at Netflix is the biggest risk is not taking any. Mm. So people will come in and try to play it safe because they hear that we have a pretty challenging culture of accountability, and which means you got to take some risks. You got to make a difference. Like, how did you have an impact today?
Yep.
Not today. It's not that obsessive, but how did you have an impact? Right. I would say for some folks, the biggest risk is the risk not taken. For myself and my own career, just given the non-traditional nature, my risks have been more like YOLO. No idea what this is. I will charm my way into this role with energy and enthusiasm. And whatever they throw at me, I don't know any better. I will try to tackle it. And I think that I didn't know what I didn't know. And for a lot of folks, that might feel really risky, but I've been able to turn that into a career that didn't turn down opportunities because maybe it didn't line up with a life plan, or I just didn't know any better. And so, you know, as opportunities have come up, I've just kind of said, hey, yeah, this is an area where I don't know a ton. I can learn a lot more. It sounds really interesting. Let's go for it. So those have been kind of the risks. Also, you know, sometimes really just making the unpopular decision. Those are also risks because, you know, you may lose some credibility with folks. But if you can really explain your thinking and you already were starting from a place of trust, then those tend to go a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. Right. You know, there's still respect there, even if you're not right in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it, you know, show your work.
Yeah.
Because, you know, hey, this is what, and some things I can't share, right? But for the things that I can, like, this is what influenced my thinking. And then at the end of the day, people can empathize with this. You have to make a call, right?
Yeah.
That could be worse.
Yep.
Yep.
So there's definitely a strong correlation between successful careers and a lot of hard work, maybe a lot of hours. I'm curious on how you tend to think about work-life integration strategies, being a person, family, and also enjoying the outdoors. Like, how do you address that?
Yeah. Oh, man. I would say, you know, when I first came into this industry in the 90s, the 9 to 9 was the grind. Or 10, you know, 10 to 7, or Silicon Valley, so people still showed up late for work.
Yeah.
Late by the rest of the country standards. And that was nuts. I remember I've slept in my office overnight. I have done crazy things, and that I really do believe that no good work happens after 45 hours. Like, you're just not thinking clearly. I'm not going to stand in the way of people who are bitten by the bug and are like, oh man, I was so energized by this work that I just, you know, went to town on it. Or, you know, there's a bit of a seesaw in terms of what the job needs at a point in time. So those needs ebb and flow. And you want to make sure that you have enough goodwill in the bank when it's go time, right? Some companies operate solely on go time. And like, you just leave bodies by the side of the road.
Yeah.
So I was raising two little kids for, you know, through sort of the thick of that. And it wasn't great. I had the good fortune of having a very understanding husband, and we were able to have some help. You know, I had an au pair for a little bit just to help out. And I, you know, in retrospect, am I happy about all the trade-offs I made? Probably not. I probably should have spent more time with the kiddos during that time frame. So when people come to me now and they're like, parental leave, or hey, I have a little league game, I'm like, family first. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, go do what you need to do for your family. My kids are all grown up now, so they're out of the house. So I have to remind myself to not keep working, even though I don't have, you know, somebody who needs help with homework and other things like that. And so I try to really prioritize fitness. I'm a bit of a fitness junkie, biking, hiking, running, weightlifting, all of the things. And I do that for my own sanity, health and sanity. It helps reduce stress. It also provides a good bookend to the day where I go, I exercise. Now I'm home and I can sort of, I'll occasionally check Slack and make sure nothing's, you know, going on that needs my attention, but I'm able to more appropriately separate from that. And I take my role very seriously in terms of making sure my teams may not have like balance, but that we are, you know, thoughtful about priorities and timelines and deliverables, so that, you know, if we do need people to be called on to go above and beyond for a little bit, that those are just spurts, right? Yeah. But you know, everybody says it's a marathon, not a sprint. It is an ultra marathon.
Yeah.
It is not a 100-yard dash. So, you know, make sure that you are planning appropriately. And if people are burning the midnight oil all the time, take up a piece of newspaper, roll it up, and just hit yourself in the face because there's something that you're doing that's not right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll try to remember that one. Yeah. So, I mean, you had a pretty impressive career and done some really cool stuff. So I'm curious, what is left for you to do? What's next? What are you trying to get done, you know, ultimately in your career that you haven't done so far?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. Kind of all, I just want to keep growing that next level of leader into exceptional talent that can continue to create healthy and productive teams, right? I briefly made VP at Chan Zuckerberg for like 2 weeks, but there I was like, but I'm like, I'm gonna go do something else where I can have a bigger impact. And so for me, it's not title, it's more how can I really arm and prepare and mold that next, and that's a little bit, it's a little bit of ego right there. Like, just to say that my mold is the right mold, but it's worked for me. And, you know, continuing to push folks to feel good about their jobs and the work they do and the value that they're bringing, and to lead in a way that is sustainable and empathetic and fun.
Yeah.
Right. So, that's the goal. And you know, you're never done. So at some point you just got to say, okay. And it's not like, well, I must achieve this level and then get this pay grade. And, you know, I mean, there are a bunch of things that I still want to see come to fruition in terms of what we're shipping, and how incredible the impact will be for our customers. And it's a never ending list, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, I get the joy out of the developing the next level.
Excellent. Well, there's one last question that I think leaders everywhere are dying to know the answer to, and you're uniquely qualified to answer. Love, Death, and Robots or Black Mirror?
God, I love Death, and Robots. Yes. I love it. I love it. But I also love Black Mirror. So my viewing habits should tell the story. As soon as Love, Death, and Robots comes out, I binge it.
Yeah.
Black Mirror, it's more of a, am I in the mood for it right now? Do I want to have my mind hurt? Do I want to feel dystopian?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they're both dystopian, you know, but gosh, the creativity in both of them. But yeah, Love, Death, and Robots every time.
Excellent. Glad to hear.
And they're
We're
short.
On the same page. Yes.
No, you can just binge and then maybe get the keep alive, but I wouldn't need the keep alive ping on binging that one because I'm awake. It's compelling.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, Catherine, I really appreciate your time today and appearing on the show. It's been great. And looking forward to catching up next time.
Thanks, Johnny. It's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Excellent. All right. Thanks. If you enjoyed today's guest and you'd like to help support the show, please subscribe, leave a rating, and share this episode. As always, thank you to our listeners, and be sure to tune in to the next episode of Executive Runtime.